error that you're looking at really is probably the most underdocumented error of the DC punk scene, I would argue.
And why is that? Why do you think that's the case?
Well, because maybe I mean there are people that were around that did some video recording. I think Evan Keeling did. He's posted some stuff on YouTube. Scott Chris Henderson took a bunch of photos, I remember. But it's not, maybe it's because no one's had the urge to actually kind of to put something together. And also, very few of the bands actually moved on to a more of a national scene. You know what I'm saying? So well, that could be a big part of it.
I think a lot of that was that the band, there were a lot of bands that, you know, that wasn't their ambition.
Sure.
You know, so a lot of bands never went national because that's not what they wanted from music and from playing.
But what I'm saying is because of that, that's probably why there's really no, say, archive or record of that period that's kind of definitive. You know, there's no band in DC book from that era. There's no documentary, to my knowledge, from that era. Maybe because, like, you know, everybody was in it at that time, but no one's felt the need to actually do something about it, I guess, until you came along.
I stumbled across that idea myself. I mean, I was looking for more information about all the bands that I had listened to growing up and had listened to living in Northern Virginia. And there just was nothing on the internet.
Yeah.
It was as if a lot of this had never existed because it wasn't on the internet, you know?
Well, the other thing, too, is basically when this scene was coming up, the internet had just really started. And I would say the majority of people in that scene didn't even have emails at that time. It was right, you know, especially in like around 93 and 94. I think I got my first got online in 95, I guess. And I didn't even know, you know, what to do with it, you know? I think the Suspects came up with a website in 96. Well, I'm correct. And we had a Flaming Skull GIF, that much I remember.
That's way ahead of your time, you know, to even have that technology at that point. That's pretty
impressive. Yeah, because, I mean, so that's another reason why you're not able to really find anything, because the internet wasn't really there. I mean, you might be able to go to, like, the DC Public Library has a punk rock archive, and they might have stuff in there. But outside of that, you know, there just was really very little record of that stuff on the internet.
Well, even before that, what do you remember? Were you a part of that first DC scene? I mean, as a fan, and in
by first DC scene, you mean like the 80s?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I started going to shows in like 1984, so I missed the Minor Threat era. However, I was there for, like, you know, Rites of Spring, Dag Nasty, Swizz, and all that stuff. I was just, you know, as an attendee, I didn't even play in bands or anything like that. So, but I would always go to DC Space, the old 930 Club, you know, whenever I could go to, occasionally HB Woodlawn would have shows. West Hall actually was the major place, really, I thought, back then, that would have a lot of the really big touring bands come through.
How did you get into that music? How did you get into going to those shows?
I I was at a boarding school, and one of the kids at the boarding school had recordings of, I guess, Minor Threat and Black Flag. And I was into skateboarding at the time, before I even knew about that punk rock stuff. So that's basically how I found out about it. And then when I got, I'd come home on the weekends or for the summer, I basically wound up kind of going to record stores and noticing these flyers. And yeah, and that's how I, I just went to, my first show was Naked Raygun, TSOL. I think GI played on that bill, another band, Serial Killers, I think. And then the second show I went to, which is kind of notable in a way, was Mission Impossible and Lunch Meat. And Mission Impossible, that was Dave Grohl's very first band. Is there anyone at home? So that was kind of cool. Then from there, I went off and, I think, wound up seeing, Dag Nasty and Rites of Spring and all that kind of stuff.
What was it about the music that appealed to you most?
It was just different. It was aggressive. It was more how I felt myself at that time.
Did you get yourself sent to boarding school, or was that?
No, my parents lived overseas, and the education wasn't as good. I guess were we in Thailand maybe or something like that. They had an American school there, but the government paid for me to go to school here in the U.S. So that's how that came about.
So your parents were actually living overseas while you were here?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's interesting. So they were. Is that part of why you were in the D.C. area?
Yeah, well, we've always lived in the D.C. area. That was like home base, right?
Okay.
So it was like, we'd go to, just like a different country, like every 2-3 years.
And do you think that like shaped you in terms of music or playing music? I imagine it would have been hard, like, making friends in those places, and you probably spent a lot of time by yourself.
Well, no, not really. I mean, there's a lot of Americans that work at embassies or on military bases, and they all have their own communities. So it wasn't really. And then there's other international communities too, as well, because you don't just hang out with Americans. You hang out, with people from Portugal or with Sweden or wherever. So, but music really didn't have much to do with that at all. I mean, skateboarding was one thing I discovered over there, was really into. But outside of that, music really didn't play much of a role. Although I will say, I remember hearing about the Sex Pistols over the kitchen table one morning when my mom was reading an article about them. I guess it was maybe in the New York Times. And she was like, she looks at me and goes, "Chris, you wouldn't listen to this kind of music, would you?" And I was like, "No, sure wouldn't, Mom." And then the first thing I did when I got to a record store in Finland, I think, was go to the punk rock section. I bought a Clash album and a Devo album. So
nice. Well, that helped.
So that was it. That was it. That was the only influence. Other than that, I didn't know what was going on in the United States, in the D.C. area at that time.
Well, I mean, growing up around the world or going to all those different places must have, opened you up, expanded your horizons, made you open to different ideas and stuff like that, too, though.
Well, yeah, but it also kind of worked as a handicap in a couple ways too, as well, because I wasn't as familiar with American culture, for example. When I was growing up in these other places, I had friends from all over different countries, right? So issues such as racism I never understood it or got it, right? So I never really thought about that much until I was exposed to it back here in the United States. So that was kind of, really weird to me. It's like I couldn't understand why people would even be like that, And then, other things like just common slang or even how you speak is different. So I actually got held back in school in, let's say, I guess it was first grade. I got held back because I could speak Danish better than English at
Huh.
that time.
Do you still speak Danish? Do you
No,
still talk? No.
I don't. I don't speak any languages. And in fact, I struggled with languages all through school. The only thing I could understand was Latin, mainly because you didn't have to pronounce it, right? No one knows how that's pronounced, so there's no language lab for that. So that was kind of Latin was kind of cool in that sense. But other than that, not really.
Well, when did you start playing music?
So I didn't start play well, I didn't start really playing in bands until my last year in college.
Oh, wow. You're
Yeah.
late bloomer.
Yeah, so I mean there, nobody in my, I guess my sister played piano a little bit, but I had zero interest in that. And so it wasn't until there was a party at our house and one of my roommates who played guitar, everyone was sitting down and kind of jamming, and there was like a bass sitting around. I believe everyone was tripping on mushrooms too. And they're like, "Chris, why don't you play?" And I was like, "I have no idea what to do." They're like, "Don't worry, man, just follow the dots." And so I just followed the dots, followed where their hands were, what dots they were on. And we started a band at college. It was kind of like a hippie jam band thing. There was really no punk rockers in my college. There was one, this guy, Evan, who was a straight edge skateboarder from Boston. And we just didn't really, I mean, we got along, but he's kind of weird. I got along better with with the hippie types.
Well, when did you get your own bass? Was that the first thing that you got, or you just took
Oh,
that?
so I will wound up, yeah, I was using I guess my friend Joe's bass, I think. And then I wound up, buying my own bass, which is still the same bass that I use today, which is a Music Man. Yeah, I bought a really nice bass because I was like, I'm going to be, because I also took some lessons to figure out what the hell I was doing. And I took some jazz lessons and then basically and bought the Music Man. I think at that time was like $700, which is really expensive in 1990 or 1989 or whenever I bought it. And then, yeah, and I would just basically sit in my room and just learn stuff by ear from everything from Parliament and Funkadelic to The Who to the Minutemen. I actually listened to a lot back then. Red Hot Chili Peppers, learned a bunch of their songs. So, yeah.
Good bass players, all those bands.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty expansive, like, repertoire of music.
Well, I wasn't playing punk rock at all because there was no punk rockers in my college. So I was playing, with, there was really, yeah. So there was no, I didn't get to play punk rock until after I got out of college and moved up here and wound up, meeting Kent Stax and Brian Harbin and those guys, Brian Gayton. And then it was like, yeah, let's, I was like, I know how to play bass and I've always wanted to play punk rock, but nobody I ever played with ever even really knew how to play that right. So.
Well, that's an impressive group of guys to fall into, just like, randomly as your first.
Yeah, I was super psyched because I remember Scream was actually one of my favorite bands growing up and to see, right? And I remember seeing like the Kent Stax version of Scream a bunch. And I always thought they were better at that point than they were when Grohl joined the band. They got a little more kind of not metally, but a little more rock and roll. I felt so I was like more of an early Scream fan, and so yeah, to get to play with Kent, I was like, hell yeah, this rules.
So those guys just weren't they weren't doing anything as a band before you got there?
I think they were just messing around in the back of this warehouse in Arlington. So yeah, and we all just kind of came together, and I was like, hey, you know, I got an idea for we had this other guy that was singing, but he was terrible, so we kind of kicked him out. And I was like, this other friend of mine, Brian Gayton, who didn't know any of those guys, I was like, it's like, let's give him a try. And he just came in, it was just awesome.
And so when did that officially become the Suspects?
93.
And how did that come about? Like, how did you guys find the name, and how did you find your first gigs?
Oh, so well, the name, so the guy that kind of connected us all together, Sean Epstein, I came up with the name, I believe, or we all agreed upon it. And like I said, like after a practice and a half, we kind of kicked him out. and so we just started, you know, we played, I guess like a house show or like a party, I guess. And then really, dude, we were like kind of stuck because there was no other punk bands at that time in DC at all. I think Bikini Kill had just kind of finished and there was really no scene. And so we were just going to get shows wherever. So we would just kind of, you know, we played Iota's, we played this place, Heaven and Hell. Yeah, we just tried to play wherever. It didn't really matter where we played at that point because there was no punk rockers around. It wasn't until we heard about this place called The Loft in Baltimore. And so we managed to get a show there. And we played there for all of like maybe 10 people, but they were 10 punk rockers. And those guys just kind of flipped out when we were playing. And they became like our biggest advocates. And because of them, they wound up telling their friends. And so we had a strong, like a heavy Baltimore crowd or Maryland crowd when we were all in Arlington, Virginia, you know. So, but because of those guys, that's kind of really kind of how it expanded from there. But it took like, we played to nobody for like a year and a half or 2 years. I mean, nobody, man.
Is that good for the band, or do you think that was hard on you guys?
Well, you know, we didn't really care at that point in time because we knew we were like the only people around. You know, I mean, Kent had told, you know, some of his buddies. Like, I'm sure Skeeter came to see us at some point or whatever. But, you know, those guys were, like, all older than it wasn't until, like, the kids in Baltimore. So, I don't know. I mean, it was, it is what it was.
How much were you aware of any other things going on in Northern Virginia at that time? Like, you know, Avail had started Jam for Man, which is what, you know, kind of, or that's where I get the homage of the name.
Yeah. So, but I think Avail started well before us.
Well, yeah, they started like 88.
Yeah, and I think they wound up moving to Richmond, so they weren't really in the area.
Yeah, well, they didn't move to Richmond till, I don't know if that was 90. It was definitely in the 90s. Definitely like early 90s when they moved.
Yeah, I mean, we were not aware of Avail at all. I mean, like I said, we were not aware of any bands. I mean, me and the singer Brian Gayton wound up at some show at Asylum, but this was after we had been playing a little bit, because there was a bunch of bands, and I think we saw like Next Step up there, which was all this kind of what I would say more the new school hardcore, like the beginning of that stuff, and that really wasn't our thing. So like we really didn't fit in with any kind of scene, and you know, and I guess there was a straight edge scene around at that time maybe, but we didn't know any of them. It was kind of like, you know, like we were just very disconnected. If there was a scene, it really, we weren't aware of it. And basically, you know, what happened is like we eventually got this place, O'Carroll's, to play at. And from there, I think that was booked by John Fox, maybe. Anyway, whoever was booking that. And we wound up playing with all kinds of different bands at that time that weren't, I guess people wouldn't really call punk. I mean, we were playing with Dismemberment Plan. We were playing with Frotus. We were playing with... Well, there were some other punk bands that were younger, but they were fans of us, like the Rejects. There's a band called Invaders from Uranus, who I guess would be our contemporaries. And then it wasn't until a couple years later when things like Positive State and Shout Bus and that whole kind of Fairfax scene, I guess, kind of exploded.
Yeah. Well, those are definitely the, you know, a lot of the great bands that were playing around that time. And certainly, like, all of them had members from Northern Virginia.
Yeah. And I mean, but like I said, at this time, like, all of these bands at that time really did not have their own scene at all, right? The scene was actually all of us.
Yeah.
So, you know, like Dismemberment Plan and Frotus fans were also Suspect fans and vice versa. You know, it wasn't really, there wasn't, oh, you're a punk rocker, you're a hardcore person, you're a indie person. It wasn't like that. You know, it's just like, oh, you're into music, cool.
And do you think the lack of the scene was because there was not a cohesive sound, or do you think it was because there weren't enough places to play, or was it because there was a lack of communication?
I sort of think it on a bigger sense, it had more to do with how Discord had shifted away from punk and hardcore to more kind of... at that time, it was mostly kind of math rocky experimental stuff that they were putting out. And while that there was a scene for that, those people weren't, there was no one doing punk rock stuff. So I think, you know, people just kind of followed, oh, this is what Discord and I guess Team Beat at that time and Simple Machines also as well, had their own little things going on, but none of it was punk rock. And therefore, nobody was really kind of playing punk rock, I guess. I mean, like I said, like we started off in a vacuum and played in a vacuum for like 2 years. And it was, and that's why, you know, that's why I think like Dismemberment Plan and Frotus, in particular, like why we actually played together quite a bit was because they didn't, you know, just nobody really fit for us. There wasn't a larger scene that was like, hey, we want to be part of that. Or, you know, I don't think any of us at that time were really like, we just didn't feel like, why, you know, there was no interest in even or desire to go play with, I don't know, maybe Branch Manager was around at that time. I don't recall, but, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, although all of it is pretty loud, energetic, guitar and drum based, you know?
Well, yeah, but not really. I mean, at that point in time, all of it was really kind of angular and math rocky and trying to be different time signatures and complicated. It wasn't about, I mean, Suspects were basically like a pop band. You know, all of our songs are like pop song structures, you know. And, you know, and I mean, and Frotus had that element, and so did Dismemberment Plan as well. You know, we were more, I guess, songwriters instead of trying to be, you know, how weird can we get with time signatures and and whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so did you model yourselves at all after the Ramones? I noticed the Chris Suspect like thing. It just reminds me a little bit of
So the reason for that is because no one could pronounce my real last name, so people just started calling me Chris Suspect.
Okay, how do you pronounce it?
Oh, it's Kendian.
Okay, that's what I assumed is the pronunciation, but I wasn't sure.
Well, good for you, man, because not many people do that.
So, okay, I mean, because that's very Ramones-ish to just be like, okay, we're songwriters, we're simple, we're straightforward, we're just gonna, you know, make pop songs but with loud guitars.
So yeah, but that wasn't really, so our influences were more of the UK sounds of, you know, for example, I'm a big fan of the UK Subs, The Damned, Cox Bar, you know, these were kind of like influences for us, Discharge. So it wasn't so much the American punk or the Ramones. I mean, of course we liked the Ramones and we liked Black Flag and that stuff, but really we were more kind of influenced by the English sound.
Mom must have been so disappointed.
They never came. My parents have never once came to see me play a show.
Really?
Yep.
That's terrible.
Yep, never.
I just meant because she's the one who started you going down that road.
I guess inadvertently.
Conversation. So, in terms of when did you guys start recording your music?
That began, I think, in 93, definitely. So the folks at the Positive Force House, which is a guy, David Curtis, who still is in the scene, and Brendan Hoare, were like, you guys got to put out a 7-inch or something. So we all kind of worked together to do a 7-inch, and we went to Inner Ear and recorded 5 songs, actually, and put 4 of them on a 7-inch.
What did you think about going to Inner Ear?
Well, we kind of went there because Kent knew Don, and we also knew, hey, this is where, you know, a lot of the good bands that we liked from DC record, so.
I meant, what was the experience, and was it, you know, was it a cool thing being there, knowing like all the bands that you had enjoyed?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I think at that time they had Studio A and B, and we were in the B studio, and this woman, Brooke DeLarco, actually engineered us. And I think she was the sound person for the Ramones at the or did their live sound or something. She had something to do with Ramones. Anyway, she really liked us a lot and kind of worked with us, so it was really, really cool.
And when were you able to then transition into putting out the full length?
Not too long after that. It was like the next year, because we had a bunch of songs and we sold out our 7-inch, which gave us enough money to do the full length, I think.
How many did you press of the 7-inch? Because I don't see any.
I think 1,000.
Online.
Maybe 1,000 to start, and then I'm pretty sure we pressed a second 1,000, maybe even a third 1,000.
Okay, and then when you moved on to doing the full LP, did you recorded that at Inner Ear also?
Yep.
And in terms of like the songwriting on there, what was the process of you guys creating songs?
Oh, well, actually, you know, we all wrote stuff together, really, man. So either Kent would come up with some riff, or I would come up with something, or Brian. All of us wrote stuff, and all of us actually contributed to each other's songs. Yeah, so there wasn't really one main songwriter. Everybody, you know, is super democratic, I would say.
Did you have favorite ones from that album?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, I liked some more than others, I guess. I mean, but I like them all. There's nothing that I cringe about.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty great album.
No, thanks. That's awesome that you said.
Well, I think it's one of the few, you know, albums from that time that really stands the test of time and is really still very, you know, very listenable today and can't really be pigeonholed to that place and time. It could fit in, you know, virtually anywhere on the spectrum of punk rock.
Yeah, well, you know, Grave Mistake re-released that 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, you guys got back together to play a show when that happened, right?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, I'm trying to recall. Yeah, it wasn't because of the record, though. I think we just got back together because Brian was like, hey, I got this shed in the back of my house and we're jamming. You want to come over and jam with me and Kent? And I was like, sure. And that kind of started like organically too. I think we actually practiced for like a year before that reunion show, but just messing around. I don't think the idea of even doing a reunion show came up, you know. It wasn't until, I guess, somebody heard, the Suspects have been kind of practicing or something like that. And maybe that's how that happened.
When you do that, are you playing the old songs? Are you just throwing out like cover ideas or are you still going like?
Actually, no, we were playing old songs. We were writing new songs. We actually had a new song that we played. Yeah, or trying to relearn like old songs that we never recorded. So,
well, that's cool. You guys all stayed in touch and stayed pretty friendly.
Yeah,
and everybody stayed in the area.
No, our singer moved to North Carolina, So that made that a little difficult. Like, so we were, so me, Kent, and Brian were just jamming, like basically the three of us. Basically, I think me and Brian would just take turns singing. But then when we got the reunion show thing, then Brian would actually came up a couple times, or, you know, more than a couple times, really, to practice for the show.
And the show was at the Black Cat, right?
Yes.
Was that was that a positive experience? Was it fun to?
Oh, dude, that was a blast. The only bummer about the whole thing, this is kind of crazy, is that at the end of the show got raided by the police and shut down because apparently somebody got stabbed at the show.
Jesus.
But it turns out nobody got stabbed.
Oh.
What happened was, is the guy that volunteered to take photos during the show for us was so enthused, got in the pit and was slamming around. I guess he fell, and he fell on some broken glass, and he cut his butt or his lower back, and was bleeding but didn't notice it. And then some girl saw blood coming out of the back of his T-shirt and then told somebody else that it looks like somebody got stabbed in the pit. And then word spread, and I guess they grabbed him and brought him outside. They're like, you know, you're bleeding. He's like, I had no idea. And they're like, you know, what happened? He's like, I don't know. And this girl's like, you got stabbed. You got stabbed. And so they wound up calling an ambulance and the police and all this. And it turns out, you know, by looking at the footage, I guess they meticulously combed through the security footage, and they see that, like, there was no fight or nothing to indicate any kind of something that would, you know, lead that to happen. And they realized that he had fallen down at one point kind of hard when he was dancing. And I guess somebody was like, oh, yeah, that's around the time I had to go clean up that broken glass. And so, yeah. So it was basically downgraded from a stabbing to a slip and fall. So.
Not exactly Altamont.
However, yeah. However, though, I have to say, you know, like, people were like, man, you just set a new bar for reunion shows in DC. So it was kind of funny, but it really sucked because I actually had my kids there, and they were like, why are the police in here? Why are they asking everyone to leave the club? And we had people that had flown in from all over the place, and like, we couldn't hang out with anybody after the show because everybody got kicked out. So.
Well, I imagine that wasn't the first show that you ever played that was shut down by the cops, though.
Oh, no. It just seemed very appropriate, actually. It's just like back in the day.
Oh, yeah. So how long was your run with the Suspects?
That went all the way to about 2000.
Okay. And what made you guys want to stop? What made you guys?
Well, we had, it was just, you know, like over time, we wanted to do more touring, you know, Brian Harbin hated touring. So he left the band, and we had, Scott playing guitar, but then he kind of, wanted to go in a more metal way, and none of us were happy with that. And basically just people kind of dropped out, and we picked up some other people here and there. And basically, you know, it was at one point we actually had a pretty solid group together together. It wasn't exactly the same band, but it was pretty good. But it's just the reality of actually having to kind of live on the road as a touring band, I think, was a little too much for our singer.
Was there a highlight in terms of touring for you?
In terms of like, I thoroughly enjoy touring, if that's what you're asking.
I just know, was there like a show or something like that where you felt like everything was working and it was just really fun or an amazing experience that you were, you know, really, really happy to achieve as a musician?
Oh, I mean, you know, the best, I don't know, the greatest part wasn't when we were touring. Those playing with the Ramones was probably the highlight. So that was pretty cool.
Where was that?
I was at a place called Capitol Ballroom that I think wound up turning into Tracks. It was the first show of Capitol Ballroom. It was, I think it was the day Jerry Garcia died. So it was August 9th, 1996. And and that was a killer show, man.
That's great.
So I don't, you know, and then, you know, like over time though, we wound up playing with all of our heroes. We played with the UK Subs a couple times, played with the Business. I don't know. We, you know, played with, you know, we actually enjoyed playing a lot of shows with Violent Society out of Philadelphia and the Blank 77 out of New Jersey. Those are kind of our touring buddy bands. So.
Now during that run, you formed Torque Records, right?
Yeah. Well, that wasn't just me. That was, so that started with the very first 7-inch of the Suspects. And that was Brendan, Dave, Curtis, and myself.
And you did that in order to put out your album?
Yeah.
Okay. And so that was the, your album was the first one that was put out.
Yeah.
And what did you think basically running a label? What was,
it was great at the beginning because our goal was the label. Well, first off, we didn't even ask. I don't even think we tried to look for any other label or anything. We were just, we're going to do it ourselves. And so we did that, you know, inspired a little bit by, you know, people like Simple Machines and Team Beat and Discord. But you know, at that time none of those folks were even putting out music like ours. So we're like, we didn't even think to ask any of them, you know, because it just didn't make sense, at least with what the kind of music they were putting out at the time. So, you know, we just started our own thing and, yeah. And the goal of it was to, you know, put out our own stuff. And then when the Suspects started actually selling a bunch of CDs, like a lot of CDs, we wound up kind of reinvesting that money into our friends' band. So we wound up putting out the Goons and Positive State and, you know, just a variety of Shoutbus and all that stuff. It was like, you know, what are we going to do with this money? Let's reinvest it and see what happens.
All of those bands were your friends. All of those bands were people that you just played with and saw and were fans of.
Yeah.
What was like the overall like idea of the label or the goal of the label? Like
the goal was to kind of just put out bands within our kind of scene that pretty much we had kind of created from scratch.
Do you think that you, I mean, because Torque is a really interesting label in terms of like the roster of bands that were on there. Like I myself, you know, personally love every one of those bands that you put out. I mean, you guys had pretty phenomenal taste at, you know, 100.
I don't know if we had phenomenal taste. It was phenomenal bands at that time that we all gravitated towards each other, even though a lot of us sounded really quite different from each other. But it was like I said, you know, when it started, we got kind of pegged as a street punk band later on, but that category didn't even exist. You know what I'm saying? So it was kind of like, it didn't, you know, it was just, you know, a bunch of us who had played and supported each other's bands and would check out our shows. You know, we just created our own scene and tried to support that scene the best we could.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. I really feel like that is almost what was missing from the scene, and you created it. Like, you made it happen, and when you look back, I mean, I don't know if that was the experience at the time, if you realized, you know, what you were doing, but if you look back, it's like the scene kind of revolves around Torque, or at least, like, all the bands that were on Torque.
Yeah, in part. I mean, you also have to remember that there were other scenes too at that time in DC that had their own thing going on too as well, but that was more like the indie twee stuff. Like, you know, I keep going back to Simple Machines and Teen Beat. So for example, like this one band, Tuscadero, who really wasn't part of our scene, however, the Suspects love Tuscadero and the Tuscadero people like the Suspects. Fans didn't really kind of get along, so I don't even know if we may have I think we played together maybe once or something, so it was really kind of just this organic scene that was kind of, you know, and people in the scene supported each other, and that was the important thing. That's why that happened.
So when the Suspects ended, did you, you know, mainly focus on working on Torque, or did you immediately go into, you know, looking for other bands to play with?
No, I kind of kept, so basically after a while running, so I think we did like almost 20 releases. And I was like, you know, getting them distributed like all over the world. And it was basically wound up happening is like all of a sudden it seemed like I was doing more bean counting and calling people up going like, hey, where's my money, or hey, can we get this in your store, than I was actually focusing on the music that got me into it in the first place. So it just kind of like, you know, it kind of fizzled out. And then also, you know, at one point a lot of the bands like broke up on the label, which meant that they really weren't able to then sell their CDs because they were not out playing for them. And so that, you know, that was a problem too, because that kind of like, you know, killed the money flow, if you will. So that was, although I did say we did get a nice influx of cash being one of the first labels to sign an MP3 distribution deal way before that time. So I don't know if you remember E-Music.
Yeah.
So E-Music was basically just throwing money at all kinds of labels asking for like the distribution rights, you know, for like basically everything under the sun. And I was like, sure. I mean, nobody I know does this stuff. And it was only for like, I think it was for like 3 years or something like that. It was an exclusive thing. And I was like, whatever, you know, fine.
So what do you do with all of those releases in terms of like streaming and stuff now?
Nothing.
Why?
I just don't have time for it, man. Okay. I really don't.
Would it be that difficult to set up, you know, some sort of streaming distribution for all of those now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so busy doing other stuff, other creative endeavors, that to me, I kind of weigh like, is this worth my time when I could be doing something else? And so, like, I'm always about moving forward, and that was a particular time in my life. And it's just like, I feel like if I go back and try to reinvest all my time into what little spare time I have into that, to me, it's a distraction for what I'm currently working towards. So I kind of, you know, it's just not worth it. So
maybe you could get some interns.
Yeah, well, maybe. So I got to start making a lot more money with photography, if that's the case, and then just start a side business for that to happen. But, you know, so, yes, I mean, primarily I spend all my time working on photography projects, or traveling for it, or giving lectures, or being a judge somewhere. You know, in like 3 weeks, I go off to I'm giving a presentation in Milan, Italy. And actually, I'm showing some punk rock work there, because I did a whole 4-year documentation of the punk scene from like 2011 to 2014, you know, here in DC, I wish somebody was doing that during our time. But
yeah, I was going to say, like, I was wondering if you had any photographs that you had taken.
I didn't even pick up a camera. That's another late. I was a late starter in picking up the bass. I was even later in getting a camera, man, because I didn't get a camera until after my son was born. My wife was like, "Hey, we need a camera, man." I was like, "We don't need a camera. Like, how are we going to capture pictures of our child?" I was like, "All right." And then I just basically got the camera, read the manual, then went out shooting to figure out how to use it. And then just kind of got, like, you know, hooked on it. And then from there, it was like, wow, this is so much easier than playing in a band, man. I don't have to have arguments with anybody else. Like, you know, it's just me that says no to something or says yes to something. I don't have to rely on anybody else, you know. And as a, you know, because one of the things when I do something or play in a band, I'm really into making it happen and take it as far as it possibly can go. And, you know, I always felt hampered in almost every band I've been in at some point, because I'm willing to, like, drop everything and just live for the art, right? So I can do that with photography. I don't have to answer to anybody, you know?
Yeah. Where can we get a look at your photography?
Just go to chrissuspect.com.
Okay. All right. I'll make sure to put a link to go along with this interview.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
And I do have a bunch of, like, there's a series on there called Suspect Device, and that has a bunch of, you know, punk bands from DC, I guess other places as well. So I basically focused on that series, because I remember when I was growing up and going to shows back in the day in the 80s, and, like, you know, when I was 14, it was, for me, it was like just super thrilling, man. It was like, it was scary. You know, there were skinheads and drugs and fights everywhere. It was pretty raucous time. And so it was just a lot of just energy, and just, it was kind of like chaos. However, when I go and look back at photographs of that time period, I was like, these are kind of boring, man. You know, I was like, so I was like, can I go back and into that realm and just shoot bands? And I didn't really care what bands I was shooting, but try to create the sense of chaos that I felt when I was young. And that's what that whole project was about.
And who were some of those bands that you were capturing?
Oh, let's see. Coke Bust was one of them. I'm trying to remember. Actually, I don't have to remember. I can look at it right here. It's in the back. I have a whole list of them. So let's see. Bands from that time. A Killer of Sheep, who are from Pittsburgh, but were awesome. Catharsis, I guess that was a reunion show. Neocons, Cop Stabber, Urban Waste, Gas Mask Terror, they're from France. Let's see. Oh, Off is in here too. Misled Youth, Youth Avoiders, Lecherous Gaze, Magruder Grind.
And
Yeah, Born Wrong.
were you able to do what you set out to do? Did you capture that that visceral
Hell
sense?
yeah, man.
This is the end of it.
Yeah, wound up actually taking me all over the world, man. I wound up having a major exhibit in Germany at Photokina, sponsored by Leica. I wound up having an exhibit in Tbilisi, Georgia, in their the Tbilisi History Museum. It was also at something called Zine World. That's some big thing in the UK. Not punk rock zine, but more like art zine kind of thing. Yeah, and it's also in the collection of the Leica Gallery Archives. It's in the DC Public Library Archives, and prints are in those. So yeah.
Did you feel any of that again yourself?
When I was shooting that stuff?
Yeah.
I was in the pit and I mean, you don't get shots like that unless you're actually kind of part of it, you know? So, but it was cool, you know, it was actually cool, you know, it was like some people kind of knew who I was a little bit, but most people really didn't, you know, when I kind of started going back into that stuff.
And you never got stabbed.
And I never got stabbed.
That's good. I would be remiss if I didn't address a couple of the other things that you did. We didn't get a chance to talk about Lickety Split at all.
Sure.
So, how did Lickety Split come together?
Oh, well, me and the guitar player from the Suspects got into a fight on stage in Baltimore, and I got a broken leg and he got a busted eyeball. So we kind of chilled out for a little bit, and then I wound up starting Lickety Split with a bunch of Suspect songs, or songs I was thinking about using for the Suspects, in the house that I was living at that time. So that's kind of how that kind of came together. And that actually kind of took off. I was kind of surprised. For me, it was just like, you know, was you know, started off that as a kind of a way to kind of practice these songs. And because he had a this guy Randy living in our house, who was a stellar guitar player. It was cool. And Chuck Roberts was always hanging out playing drums, so.
Nice. I really love that first Lickety Split album too.
Yeah, that was a good record. So basically that wound up turning into a record, and so we had Suspects and Lickety Split going at the same time, because me and Brian made up, of course. It wasn't the first time we've gotten into a fight on stage, so that was one of the things people like seeing about the Suspects. They're like, are they gonna fight tonight?
You were saying that when you're in a band, you want to take it as far as it can go. Was it hard balancing that when you're in two bands at the same time?
It wasn't so much of a balance at that time because I was all in. I was just working like a part-time job, basically doing Torque full-time and playing in bands full-time.
And so, I mean, that must have wore you out, though, doing Torque.
Oh, yeah, but I keep going, man. I have boundless amounts of energy, it seems.
I mean,
you wouldn't believe the kind of shit that I've been doing this weekend. I have a list on a chalkboard of 14 things I need to get through, and this is one of them. But it's been kind of crazy. So
better than me. We've all been sick out here, so this is just like a whole family, like just
you got the measles.
Yeah, nothing like that. But I mean, it's just everybody is coughing. Everybody has a fever. Everybody has a sore throat. And that includes like a 7-month-old baby.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty brutal this weekend around here.
So this is good for you. Like, because I know from having a baby, like, you know, when I had my son, it was like almost impossible to go out and play, which is the reason why I stopped playing in bands. It's like I couldn't really go on tour or anything. Because I think at that time I was in a band called VPR, which I actually thoroughly loved that band. That was great. I just couldn't really go on tour. And I also broke my hand at that time. And so, that's how I found photography. It's like, hey, I don't have to rely on anybody. So like you doing this podcast series, you know, it's similar in a way. You have a kid, but you can do the podcast on your own time. You don't have to rely on anybody else. It's kind of cool.
But then I also have a band. So.
Oh, you do? Okay. What's your band?
My band's called Los Angelinos.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm in the same boat because I also have a neighborhood band here, which is kind of hilarious, called the Spice Boys. And we're doing basically kind of old school rock steady and dance hall style reggae.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, and it's just kind of hilarious because it's a bunch of middle-aged people from the neighborhood. Although, you know, we do have one person of note in the band, which is Eric Morgan. Do you remember him?
No.
Eric Morgan was like a keyboard player for the Pie Tasters.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't he play?
And he was in Tero Bolero, which was another band around at that same time.
Doesn't he play on some of the Lickety Split stuff too?
Yes, he does. Yeah.
And you guys did like maybe a reggae song on the first Lickety Split album. I think.
Yeah, we just got something. Yeah.
So you
probably my favorite song on that record, actually.
That's a really good cut. So you're sort of exploring that a little bit more, huh?
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, it's kind of fun, but it turns out people like us, so we're getting asked to play a lot of places now, so which is pretty cool. But it's hard because we're like 8 people, and we keep adding more, I think.
That sounds awesome.
So, yeah, it's kind of fun.
You mentioned VPR. I really like VPR also, and you know, a couple of the guys that I've had on the show were in VPR also. Dave Stone,
yeah,
did some time in VPR, and I think even Jeff Berman played for a little while in VPR.
Yeah, too. He was a founding member of VPR.
And what was the experience like in VPR?
I remember seeing VPR in Arlington, and I forget the name of the place. It was kind of like the equivalent of O'Carroll's, but it was a new place. They were just sloppy as hell. And most of them, I think, were pretty drunk at the time, but I thoroughly thought they were just great and having a good time. And then their bass player, Dave Linehan, he either injured himself or had to go somewhere or something. I forget what the circumstances were, but I volunteered. I was like, hey, man, I would love to play with you guys while Dave is out. And that's how that kind of came to be. So. And then, actually that band had so many members, man, like 12 or so different members, but like all of us are pretty much friends and stuff. And there was I guess Jeff Berman came through with his band Divided Heaven at one point and played The Pinch or something. And I think like 8 or 10 of us were there. And at the end, we all just got on and started trying to play whatever VPR songs we knew. It was just hilarious. Then we got this big group shot of everybody. That was kind of fun. So that was a good time. VPR was nothing but just about kind of having fun. And that was actually really, really cool.
That's killer. Well, I mean, you have been involved with a really cool amount of bands, you know, through either putting out their music or playing in these bands. You've been a part of some really great stuff.
Yeah, so, well, it's been a lot of fun, I have to say.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you, just because you have some experience of doing this too. You were on the radio in DC for a while also, I hear.
I didn't get a
chance to hear that show, but tell me about that, the radio show.
So I, in a very weird way, wound up getting my own show on WJFK, which is the CBS radio here, and that station had the likes of Howard Stern and G. Gordon Liddy and Don and Mike, who are very popular locally here. You know, they launched like a lot of national kind of radio personalities. Basically, how that happened, I was at the Black Cat one night and talking with this guy, and I guess he knew who I was from just Suspects or Torque Records or whatever. And he was asking me like, what do you think about radio in DC? And I was like, I think it sucks. And he's like, yeah, well, what's wrong about it? And I was like, well, you know, there's no kind of alternative station that plays underground music or what have you. And then he's like, do you want a show? I'm like, who are you? He's like, oh, I'm the program manager for WJFK, and hands me his card. I thought the whole thing was a joke, man. It took me like a week. And then I think I sent him an email. I said, so are we serious about this? And and that's how that came together. So,
and
the only thing radio wise I had done before that was just college radio, which was kind of boring because it just broadcasted through the radiators of the dorms.
Who were the people that were on the show with you?
Oh, so we had Chuck Roberts, Billups Allen from Shoutbuzz fame. And then this other woman, I can't remember. We had a couple of women, Rebecca, Zoe, this guy Mike the intern, who's kind of pain in the ass. Chris Henderson was part of that too, and I say that with love and affection. He was the rudest phone answerer ever in the world, man. People would be like, that guy's such a dick when I call in and try to get on the air. So it was kind of like just kind of this cast of characters. And it was also great because then I could leave and go on tour and have Chuck run the show or Billups do it. And it was kind of fun. And that lasted for basically 2 years. How that really ended was because the station management wound up moving to New York to work, I think on Sirius, the beginning of Sirius satellite radio. And in the interim, they put the sales manager in charge of the whole station. And when he's looking at the numbers, our show brought in like next to nothing compared to what the other shows brought in. And he was just like, we're going to try something different in this time slot. So that's how like we got kicked off of there. Wasn't because of any incident, although we had plenty of incidents, but it wasn't because of something major.
Well, at least you were bringing some decent music to the DC area for a little while.
Yeah, it was fun while it lasted, man. That was definitely cool.
Yeah, that's great. Well, keep in mind, I mean, I know you have all your other projects, but now that podcasting is here, you know, you could always put together another radio show.
I do that professionally, man. That's partly how I make my living. I was hoping we could have done this interview like during the week, because then we could have done it from my studio by Union Station, where I have really nice microphones, full-on soundboard, and we would have sounded great for your next episode.
then it would sound too good. It would put all my other episodes to shame.
Maybe it would inspire you to, stop using the phone on the road. And, you probably could get a decent mic, though, in your car. Are you just using the phone mic?
Yeah. And, I mean, that's why it sounds like crap. That's sort of always been, one of the things about me. I'm very DIY and just make it happen, get it done, and worry about it afterwards, fix it in post kind of thing. But I'm always
not
about
what you do in post with a recorded phone call.
Yeah, I know. But I'm all about just let's capture the magic. Let's capture the moment.
Sure.
Yeah. So all right, cool. I am glad that we got a chance to capture this moment with you and hear about all this stuff. And I'm really impressed that you're continuing to be an artist every day and continuing to find new and different avenues to express yourself artistically. Yeah.
I don't see that ever stopping. Otherwise, I'd be bored out of my mind or something. I don't know. Yeah, well, thanks, man. That's really cool to hear it said that way. So thank you.